Welcome to the Booktopia podcast. I'm John Purcell. I'm sitting here with Sarah McDewling, and we're across from Flo McDonald, who has come in to talk about Where the River Runs, her new book. Welcome.
Hello, John. Hello, Sarah.
Hi.
How are you?
Great. On the front of your book, it now says rather boldly, over 500,000 books sold.
That's a lot of books.
That's a big, big number.
How does that feel?
Actually, my mum, my auntie was talking to my mum on the phone, and she said, "Is that real?" And mum said, "I have no idea." So yeah, I can't say that I had any idea either. So yeah, it's very humbling that people have supported me as much as what they have. Pretty amazing.
How many books is it? Now you're doing two books a year. It's sort of hard to keep abreast of it. How many books have you actually written? How many novels in a row? Is it like 7 or 8, 10, 12?
I think this one's the 12th. I think I've just finished the 13th. I think that's right. And I can tell you I've done two children's books. I know that bit.
It's amazing because, your career and my career here at Booktopia are kind of lined up.
Yeah.
I joined here and you started to publish at the same time. We sort of have been stalking each other online.
For a long time.
Yeah, for a long time. Because you live on the other side of the world, on Esperance now, yeah?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's not that far.
It's not that far?
I got here in a day.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
You're a very fast walker.
On the side of the world.
Well, it's not exactly we can sort of bump into each other and have coffee, like, as regularly as we might.
Not as regularly as, like, some people could, but, yeah, we can still organise that any time.
Yeah. I want to talk about your new novel, Where the River Runs. Can you give us a little bit of a what would you do if you were asked a question by someone who hadn't read it yet and just said, what's it about?
There's sort of two storylines in it. There's Chelsea, who she's estranged from her family and she hasn't been home for a long time, and she's heading home and she's got to reestablish a relationship with her dad. And her mother has died and her brother was killed in an accident. So, you know, she's got to reestablish a whole brand new relationship with her father, and she's got a little daughter with her. So when I, as a farmer, we don't get to go home for Christmas or back to my parents for Christmas very often because mum and dad are in South Australia, and farming and being away from animals during summer isn't a great thing. But now that I'm able to go home, I went home for Christmas last year, and complete with an L plater in the car, we drove the Nullarbor to go home.
Wow. And there should be a book just about that.
There could have easily been. And I just, some of the feelings that I had when I was going home, I thought I can really put them to good use and put them to Chelsea. So I wasn't going home to mend a family rift or anything crazy like that, but you know how it's bizarre how your body remembers how the road goes when you haven't been home for so long, and there's all these, I don't know, memories that you've, because you've been there for and driven that road so many times before. It doesn't matter if it was 5 minutes or 10 years ago, your body still remembers it. So there's lots of that that I thought, I've got to put those emotions to good use because otherwise they'll probably do my head in. But the other thing is Dave Burrows makes just a small appearance in this one, and he, while I was home, the house at mum and dad's used to be my Nana and Papa's, and everything of Nana and Papa's is still there. So Nana's writing desk's still there. Papa's diaries are still there. So I was doing the good author writer thing and going through Nana's writing desk to see, you know, if I could find anything that was useful. And there's a little, and I knew about it and I'd forgotten, but there was just a little paper clipping about an inch big, and it told of the story of a 3-year-old boy that fell off the back of a wagon back in the early 1900s, and he was killed, and his grave is buried on where mum and dad live. And I thought, oh, that's pretty intriguing. I wonder how many, you know, people are in unmarked graves across Australia and all that sort of thing. So Dave enters the novel when he finds that the water, a flood water, has sort of opened up a grave, and he's got to work out who that is. So that's a very long-winded explanation of Where the River Runs.
I love the fact that you plumb your own families. Writers, they've been called vampires in the past. They suck the blood out of their own. Is that something that you've done throughout your career? Do you feel your writing
career... What, kill my family?
Suck the life out of them. But, yeah, through your career, do you feel that there's a shift from... in the way you write, the way you where you find stories, how you generate stories? Are things coming easier, or is it more difficult?
It's more difficult. Yeah. I wouldn't say that writing ever gets any easier. I tell you what, I love the editing process because all the hard work's done.
Yeah.
Finding ideas is when I'm on song and I'm not, you know, under pressure or anything, ideas come usually reasonably easy. So I can read a newspaper article or I can hear a radio interview and think, oh, I can do something with that. So, like, I had a conversation, going back to my family again, but, Emerald Springs started because I was having a conversation with Dad about, he was the treasurer of the Rodeo Committee, and he, I said, you know, you're carting all this money in your car on the way home. So, like, in the middle of the night, what happens if somebody carjacked you? He goes, oh, middle of South Australia, that's not going to happen. I said, oh, it might not, but I can make it happen type thing. So, you know, it was just one tiny, tiny conversation. And Silver Clouds was the same. You know, there was an ABC interview where the guy was talking about some rings that had been found next to a waterhole up north in WA, and he asked the listeners to call in with their first paragraph of a book. And when he interviewed me, I said, did he remember that story? And he did. And it was, I said to him, well, it's not the first paragraph, it's the whole book on those rings.
Yeah.
Wow. So, yeah, so it's just tiny, tiny little things.
Do you, because it's two books a year, is the idea for the next one happening while you're writing? Like, are you that far ahead? Or do you
I really try not to do that, because otherwise I'll want to write the book that I'm not supposed to be writing. I need to finish the one that I am writing. But, you know, like I was just saying to you guys before, it's really difficult because I've just finished writing the one that's coming out in April next year, which is the second in the Dave Burrows series, and I'm so entrenched in Dave's world, and that's, I've got to actually drag myself back and think, okay, well, now we need to talk about Chelsea.
But Dave, like, he's moving around, right?
He moves everywhere. He's just like the water's coming down the creek. He's just like going.
So when you started doing research about these bodies that are, you know, buried in unmarked graves, did you discover things that surprised you, or is it just part of the way in which life was lived in those times?
Just part of the way that life was lived. There's I went to on the side of the hills near where Mum and Dad are. There's like these. There's four or five tiny little graveyards. Sometimes they've only got, you know, one or two people in it, and you know, whether those families are still in the district or whether they're not, you know, there's still people there that, and there's graves there that haven't got, you know, it's a grave, but there is nothing written there, so you've got no idea who it is. So it's really intriguing. I'll tell you what, some of those little cemeteries are very funny in the way that the rabbits have also dug in to in around the graves. And I looked at one, because there's a massive big hole there, and I had my daughter with me, and I looked at it and I said, do you reckon they've escaped?
Zombies. Next book idea.
Zombies in the bush.
But that's where, you know, there's, when people died, they didn't have the ability to hold their bodies and not bury them. They had to, then and there, and then they had to walk on and leave their family members behind. That was just the way life was.
Now, you're doing two books a year, but you're also involving yourself in Rotary, in organisations, an organisation that's set up to help people with domestic violence on properties, and they're like, it's not like you just keep piling it on. Like, it seems, I get terrified. Yeah. I get terrified at the idea of two books a year. I mean, one book every 2 years, nice. That sounds about right.
Well, the trouble is, all the other things I'm involved in don't pay me. Right. So I've been completely honest about that.
But you've also got a hankering to get back into
farming. Yeah. I did buy a farm at the beginning, or in November of last year. I went partnership with a friend from Rotary, and unfortunately I had a back injury in January, so that I ended up having to sell my half because I had spinal surgery, and that hasn't sort of gone quite as well as what we'd hoped. But yeah, I look, so Breaking the Silence is a not-for-profit organization that I've started to support women, or individuals, it's not just women and children, but individuals in what we call the Triple R area, so it's regional, rural and remote areas. And what we're doing with that We've got we find all the services for each town that there is, and we make sure that people can access the. It's like a directory, I suppose. So there's icons and very easy download, quick downloading type icons. So you can look for accommodation and find out within one click that that's what is available in your town. And we're working towards getting some online counsellors and a few other things like that. And it's very exciting because I've just got a meeting with His Excellency Peter Cosgrove at the end of November. So that's really cool. So I'm on the I'm on the Australian Women Agriculture Board. I'm the WA rep for that, and the National Rural Women's Coalition Communications Resource Team. So yeah, just a few things.
How many women are out there? How many women are out there as farmers now in WA? Like, are there hundreds of women farming by themselves? And
Well, there's. Whether they're farming by themselves or whether they're farming in their own right or alongside their husbands, well, they're beginning to get the recognition now. And I think that it's no different to what it was, you know, back when I first started farming. It's just that they are getting the recognition. And there's a lot of young girls going through, I hate saying young girls, but, you know, women going through, going into research and development and other places that they wouldn't have otherwise gone. It's a lot more open. Everyone's a lot more accepting than what they were when I first started, you know, like how many years ago that I'm not going to mention.
And in the small towns, they're accepting as well?
It would be very unusual for them not to be accepted. I think there's still, you know, you're still going to have the really old stockies that started, you know, that might be in their late 60s, early 70s that turn up and knock on the door and goes, where's hubby, missus type thing. Yeah. But, you know, they would be fairly few and far between.
Yeah, the world has changed.
Mm. And that's for a good thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's, I mean, when you're out there, because you do a lot of travelling as well, like from a place in that area. I mean, you must be going around with your.
What are you saying?
Not like that. I'm not suggesting that, Fleur. We're open to it. We want to go down that road in that discussion. We're happy to go down there if you like to go down that road. Fleur gets around. No, that wasn't what I was suggesting.
I'm so confused.
How did we get here? But yeah, with your writing when you're out there, because I mean I never turn off. Like being involved in these organisations is a worthy thing, but also as a writer is a good thing because the stories just keep rolling down, and you continually have a hand in it. I mean, to have the accident this year and to have to get out of it.
I wanted to circle back to that too. Having heard all the amazing things that you're doing aside from writing two books a year and then that you had surgery, like how are you able to do all of that?
Yeah, well, I reckon if you asked my publisher, Annette, she wouldn't be. She would tell you that she had to be very kind to me at the beginning of this year. After the surgery, it took me a long time to get over the anaesthetic, and the drugs that I was on were really strong, and so I probably didn't write for probably, I don't know, maybe 3 months. So now, of course, I had the deadline. So I'm not really quite sure how many extra weeks she gave me, but a lot. In fact, there was probably a time where I thought perhaps the book wouldn't end up coming out, but we got there in the end. But yeah, the drugs were. I can tell you, if you want to try a really good drug, Endone is like slipping into a nice hot bath. Lyrica is the most dreadful drug that there ever existed.
So what was how did it happen? What was the?
Oh, it was. So I had a prolapsed disc, and that was pressing on my sciatica nerve, so I couldn't walk, and so I was only doing something very. Normal. I was bending down to lift a fence up to let my dog underneath to get a drink from the trough, and I thought, oh, that really didn't feel very nice. And I got home and I got on the bed, and I didn't get off until the ambulance came and picked me up the next morning, and then I went to Perth on the Royal Flying Doctor and they operated the next day. And of course I had to do it right at New Year's Eve time. So I spent New Year's Eve in hospital. Which was so exciting. Can you believe how much people rage in hospitals? So, yeah, it was a pretty interesting start to 2018.
And then because these days they really mean they don't let you lie around, they get you up and moving around, they do that to you?
They actually, I still couldn't walk. I can remember the surgeon coming in to me after the operation saying, you'll be able to walk to the bathroom this afternoon. Mm-hmm. And it still took me 4 days because it was the nerve had been damaged. And I've still got no feeling in my right leg and my right foot. So, and that probably won't come back.
Does that affect walking? I've got
used to that. When I say no feeling, it's like I've got pins and needles all the time. So I've sort of got used to it. But sometimes I feel like that leg's going to give out from underneath me. But it's made riding really difficult because it doesn't like the pressure of sitting all the time. So I spend a lot of time standing up riding now.
So you do this? I've got a stand-up desk.
They're great.
I was an idiot. I wrote for ages and sitting down, not a very good desk and not a very good chair, and wondered why I had back problems over and over again. And then I went, oh, yeah.
Let's
do that. I have a stand-up desk here. Mm. I didn't have one at home.
I want a stand-up desk.
Yeah, they're great. But swimming and walking are really important too, and I do a lot of that. Stand-up desks are totally necessary. And, you know, talking to Rachel Johns, she's got a desk on a treadmill that she walks on. And I've not been brave enough to try that. I don't know how you'd actually type while you're doing that.
It seems like it would be awkward.
But the other thing
like
about that
your
is...
tummy and
yeah, that's right. But the other thing about that is that I've just invested in some voice technology software, so I can talk and it writes for me. So, you know, if you were doing that while you're walking on a treadmill, that would work, because like my hands, this last book that I've just finished writing, which is the second of Dave Burrows, I wrote 50,000 words in 5 days.
Right.
So, you know, my hands didn't like that very much.
Yeah. So. Well, I mean, the problem with dictating, Henry James's books were quite thin until he started to dictate his books, and they got really fat. They get bigger and bigger and bigger as his career goes on, because he just starts dictating them. It just fills up.
It's going to be interesting to see how that works for me, because there's a real difference between, you know, writing with your hands to writing with your mouth and your thought process. Because a lot of the time when I'm writing, I don't even know what I'm going to write until I sit at the computer and it comes out. And sometimes I look back and I go, I don't even remember writing that as such. Mm-hmm. So, like, I'm really lucky that I can go into my subconscious easily and be able to type. But to be conscious and having to find the words that you would normally just find with your fingers is going to be interesting to see if that works as well as what I think it could or hope it can.
Well, it could
you haven't started that technology for this book?
No, I didn't have it for Where the River Runs, no.
It might be that you might end up with more clay to play with when you're doing the editing, so you've got more stuff than less. But I'm with you. I mean, my brain works so totally differently when I'm talking and when I'm typing. Same with listening to audiobooks and reading books.
Yeah.
It's a very different experience for me.
Yeah, right? With your senses and everything, it's just really different.
Yeah.
Mm. That's very interesting.
You said recently that you haven't been reading, and I can understand why with the...
You have no time to read. I'm still stuck on that. In January this year, you were in hospital with back surgery, and since then have written two books. That just blows my mind. But sorry, John.
I don't like to be bored.
But it makes perfect sense. Not that much reading time. Di Morrissey comes in, and she gives herself this nice little period between the books she does every year, which is her, you know, glutton reading period, where she just gobbles down as much as she can. But your must get smaller and smaller as you do two books a year.
I've got a timetable up on my whiteboard that I'm supposed to stick to. I never do, but I'm supposed to stick to it. And one of the things that I do when I first get up in the morning is sit and read. So I've got a beautiful veranda with a massive big lawn and gum trees and everything. So I go and sit outside, have a coffee, because I never operate without coffee, and I just sit and read for 3/4 of an hour or so. Trouble is when you're in a really good book, then nothing happens until you finish that. But, you know, that's okay. We didn't really need to write our 2,000 words today. So that's how I try and fit the reading in. And I've started reading in bed again, you know, when I go to bed at night, which I wasn't doing for a really, really long time. So
I feel it's like refilling, because I get so inspired to write when I'm reading someone who's great. You know, it's really exciting me about writing and reading again.
Like, yeah.
And sort of just if I don't have that for a while, if I'm writing too much and I'm not filling in, like putting the petrol back in,
yep, yeah,
which is the books.
And that's what I kept saying to myself. And because I am so busy, sometimes I feel like I am really, really empty, and I know then I've either got to go to the beach or I've got to go for somewhere that I can just sit and be and not have all the million and one things running around in my head. You know what? I wish I was Dumbledore, and I wish I had one of those wands that you could just sort of empty in. You know how, I can't remember what book it was in, but he just emptied his head out into this cauldron.
And he could
still go and look at his memory. Sometimes I really wish I had one of them.
Can you get rid of the ones that just reoccur, the bad?
Yeah, memories? That would be fantastic. Yeah, we would delete them.
Yeah, the ones that come up at 3 o'clock in the morning and you lie there just going over and over and over. I think those are...
Yes.
Just delete.
Yeah.
Just... I reckon the technology will come.
Well, apparently our brains are kind of...
Programmable.
They're programmed to do that. We don't remember everything because...
It's called repressing memories.
That's good. I like the idea of repressed memories.
Yeah, and I think, yeah, it is possible, like being serious, it actually is possible because most people that have followed my career know that I had a marriage breakup 4 years ago and I had a lot of, there was a lot of emotional abuse in that. And I've done a heap of hypnotherapy and it's been the best thing that I've ever done.
And then, and that is to get rid of it, or is that to...
It's to be able to deal with it and not let it actually affect you. Yeah.
I'm signing up.
So... So was that to unrepress memories or to...
Repress memories.
Yeah, just be able to park them down the end of the road, know that they're part of you and that they're always going to be there, but they don't affect you as much as what they did when I first left the marriage. Yeah, so, and I've only managed to do that this year. I've done a lot this year.
This has been a big year for you.
Yeah.
Wow. I'm a bit in awe.
So thank you so much for coming... to Booktopia. It's been wonderful, and congrats on getting so much done in a year that has been jam packed for you. And I'm so happy that you're well and you're well enough to come in here and
thank you.
And sit in our very uncomfortable cheap chair.
I love coming to Booktopia. It's one of the highlights of being a writer.
Thank you so much, Fleur.
Thank you.
And you can get hold of all of Fleur's books at booktopia.com.au right now.
Thanks for listening to the Booktopia podcast. Don't forget to subscribe to us on SoundCloud and iTunes. And if your eyeballs need a workout, check us out on YouTube at Booktopia TV. And don't forget, for all books featured on this episode and all episodes of the Booktopia podcast, head to Booktopia, Australia's local bookstore, at www.booktopia.com.au. Thanks for listening.